Hello and welcome again to another edition of Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Parent. Coming up on today's program, U.S.-China relations and Obama's second term. What will change and what won't change? We also have a bit of a backstory on the Party Congress that's taking place in Beijing and South Korea to probe all nuclear reactors. We have this and more, so stay tuned. This is Focus Asia Pacific, putting the focus on the Asia Pacific. Well, the race for the White House is over, and Barack Obama will serve his second term as the United States president after his decisive victory over Mitt Romney. In his victory speech, Mr. Obama focused, as you might imagine, was on America and Americans. But he also gave a hint to the rest of the world what they can expect over the next 4 years. First and foremost, Barack Obama faces huge problems at home, a massive deficit, a weak economy, and high unemployment. Added to those, Republican control of the House of Representatives and the tarnishing of America's image overseas. The all-important relationship with China in particular continues to pose challenges, and how those challenges play out are equally important to both countries and, of course, for the rest of the world. We have this report from Karen Snowden.
Foreign policy doesn't loom large during most U.S. election campaigns, but China was mentioned dozens of times during the debates between the two candidates. Far from being a lame duck second term, Helen Ware, Professor of Peace Studies at Australia's University of New England, says Barack Obama will have almost free rein on most foreign policy settings.
If Obama has initiatives he wants to take, now is his time to do it. He's facing a whole different political situation, particularly with respect to foreign affairs, which he doesn't have to get bills through the House of Representatives. He can simply pursue his own initiatives.
I do believe that Beijing will welcome Obama's election.
Joseph Chen is Professor of International Relations at the City University in Hong Kong.
Because at least the Obama administration is a known quantity, whereas Mitt Romney certainly presents a threatening unknown factor, especially when he's indicated in this election that he would label China as a currency manipulator on the very first day of his office.
Economics and just getting a job are the dominant issues facing many Americans, and Obama has a long way to go to fulfill his promises. Tony Nash, Managing Director of IHS Consulting in Singapore, says foreign policy will also take a lot of his time.
I think the economy is improving, although it's very slow. And I think there are a number of international issues and foreign policy issues that are becoming more important. There's already talk about who his next Secretary of State will be. And so as Hillary Clinton, who's been a very good Secretary of State, rotates out, the question is who will have to fill those very large and very capable shoes.
After the blow-up of territorial disputes in the East China and South China Seas in 2010, the bilateral relationship cooled. China is expanding its military, while the U.S. is intent on remaining the world's major military power. Beijing resents what it considers is Washington's containment strategy, embedded in Obama's renewed policy towards the Asia Pacific. Joseph Chen says Beijing will adopt a wait-and-see attitude to the president's second-term priorities.
China needs a peaceful international environment to concentrate on its modernization. It certainly wants a good relationship with the United States. And it believes that the United States probably still has its hands full with issues in Iraq, Afghanistan, Iran, Syria, North Korea, and so on. And it will not be able to concentrate on China.
China is undergoing its own leadership transition, reportedly with sizable rifts between factions at the top, and Beijing is also preoccupied with domestic economic and social issues. It also wants international recognition and a bigger role in the multilateral arena. Tony Nash says handling the growing economic and political competition between the US and China will test both sides.
If the US doesn't give China the respect effect an accommodation at some of these multilateral fora, I think it'll be problematic. And I don't think the U.S. will do that. I really don't. But the U.S. and Chinese leadership recognize, I think, mutual respect, and I don't think anybody wants any sort of confrontation.
The other big political news event happening in the world is happening, well, at the other end of the world, in China. This week, party officials from around the country are meeting in Beijing to decide who the next leader of the country is and who the next members of the standing committee are. Now, this is despite the fact that this is very well rehearsed and more or less everybody in the inner circle already knows who it is, but they're doing this show nevertheless. Now, leading up to this party gathering, there have been some strange things that have been going on. Now, as we were preparing this story, I was thinking, well, because by the time this show airs, something may have changed, so we can't really give an update. But I thought we would focus on the more obscure side of this gathering and the backstory at the same time with reporters covering it. Now, did you know that during the party congress, the following: flying kites is banned, flying remote control airplanes is banned, even, believe it or not, pigeons. That's right, keeping pigeons in Beijing is a popular hobby, and they're, well, effectively grounded. Anyway, there's also, of course, some other things that are banned. Like, for example, if you're in a taxi and you're driving near one of the venues, you have to keep the back window down. This is to prevent you from throwing out leaflets with things like democracy, etc., etc. And just before contacting our Beijing correspondent, Jocelyn Ford, who's standing by on the line, we found out that ping pong balls have also been banned. And we're now joined by Jocelyn Ford.
Ping pong balls, that's my absolute favorite. Can you imagine what would happen if they allowed people, especially people traveling in taxis, to carry ping pong balls with them? They might write a protest, an anti-government protest on the ping pong ball, and throw it across the road. And you know how difficult it is to catch a bouncing ping pong ball, even in the ping pong capital of the world. I mean, that would be a total mess. So, you know, it makes complete sense that they're banning ping pong balls. I don't understand why you think this is strange. having said that,
by the way, Jocelyn, I should mention that you also just informed me about pigeons.
Yes, pigeons. Well, you know, there's a bit of logic here. Ping pong balls and pigeons, and it's not just because they both begin with P. Pigeons, you could tie a protest to their leg as they fly around. And as you know, there are sort of pigeons in Beijing. I mean, it's quite a popular hobby to raise pigeons, and they tend to fly around in circles and predictable ways. I mean, what, you know, good gosh, who knows what kind of trouble they could cause.
Now, with this kind of security taking place, because you've been in China now for a number of years, is this the first time that you've seen these kind of very odd, very strange security measures in place?
Well, actually, no. And in fact, there is a reason to be concerned about pigeons, because in the 1990s, in fact, dissidents did release pigeons carrying slogans tied around their legs. So, I mean, I think you need to take into consideration that China has thousands of years of practice of suppressing free expression and people finding their way around it using very clever methods. We had other strange issues. Back in 1995, the Women's Conference, the UN Women's Conference, was held in Beijing, and they wanted taxi drivers then to carry blankets in their car. Why, you might ask? Okay, perhaps you've already guessed. Because, of course, the women coming might streak across the road naked, and you'd want to cover them up if they did. I mean, this is the sort of logic that you know, people here are not used to. The people in leadership positions are not used to the ordinary folk going out and expressing themselves, and they're quite fearful of it. Something like at least 100 dissidents have been rounded up and put under house arrest, according to some human rights organizations, and others are being beaten or harassed by thugs. So you might say, well, why, you know, China's economy hasn't done that badly. Yes, it is no longer double digit. It's now growing by 7 or 8%. But why are they so afraid? And the issue is this. It is actually, there's talk now that unrest happens more when people's lives are getting better, because then they're no longer struggling so much, and they realize that they're not as happy as they thought they should be after getting all this material wealth. So that's a bit of background for you.
Now, recently there was a video actually that made its rounds on YouTube of a Chinese artist who's had a lot of problems with the law in China and officials, Ai Weiwei. And he's doing the very famous Korean pop song Gangnam Style. And there's a lot of political messages in it. He's dancing, and there's one part, he has handcuffs and everything. You just mentioned, of course, a lot of dissidents have been rounded up. But yet again, this handover of power is so scripted. Are they doing this because they are expecting some type of surprises, or is this just the way of doing business?
Well, this is basically the way of doing business. And as I suggested, and if you just mentioned that especially with the internet, more and more people are finding clever ways around this. For example, another bit of information that's being restricted is coverage of the U.S. presidential election. You could say, well, what's the problem here? The concern could be, and I'm speculating here, is that people in power don't want the Chinese people to look at how the U.S. change of government happens, that people actually go out and vote, and compare it to what happens here, where there's almost no information. Now, having said that, there's a pop singer, Gao Xiaosheng, and he's got this online talk show. And so he didn't exactly challenge the censorship rules, no free reporting on this, you're only supposed to use whatever Xinhua says. But he did go out and explain how the U.S. Electoral College works. Now, it may sound sort of mundane, but he basically said you got to balance the population with the rights of the states. And though he didn't compare it to China directly, which is probably what the censors would not like, the average Chinese person watching this can figure that out. So, I mean, all of this, the government wants control. Face saving is very important here. They want to make it look like everything is going smoothly. The whole town is plastered with these, long live the Communist Party, these posters of Communist Party heroes. But, everybody knows the real world is coming out on the internet by ordinary people, not by whatever the government censors is. That you can believe in.
Now, just before the Party Congress took place, of course, there was a lot of talk in the media, not just in China, but also around the world, surrounding Bo Xilai. Now, he's been stripped of his Communist Party membership. Are people then now speculating that after this transition of power takes place and is done with, that then they will start going after Bo Xilai?
If you can tell me the answer to all this, we should be doing another job. One does expect that the legal system, the court system will, there will be charges against him, and he will, the case will be brought to court. And some people see that as progress, that he didn't just disappear. In the past, folks who have offended the top leaders have sometimes, for example, died in a plane crash. There are some who say this could be progress should this case, and presumably it will, go to court.
Now, Jocelyn, you've been in China, as I said a moment ago, for a good number of years. And of course, every 4 years, there's the National People's Congress that takes place. And then every 10 years, the transition. The last time was from Jiang Zemin to Hu Jintao. What is it like for a foreign correspondent or even a local correspondent to cover this in China?
We all wish we knew. I mean, that's every 5 years they have this party congress, and usually the president will customarily get two terms. So it's every 10 years that there's a change of power. And I actually was here 10 years ago. And what happened then was basically the new leadership lineup came out, and you're supposed to look at the order in which they come out and then presume their new position. And one would hope there would be an option to question them. But if my memory serves me correct, there was no option at all to ask any questions. We just watched and listened to some very staid statement, and that was it. It was incredibly formal. It made you feel like you were in a court. I mean, almost an imperial feeling to it. This was in a great hall of the people. So that's sort of how this is all expected to conclude. Now, in the interim, what's going on behind closed doors, it's anyone's guess. Having said that, there's some sort of interest. There are a few ways to measure whether political reform is happening to any degree. And the measure last time was that not everybody got 100% of the votes. In other words, in the real old days, under Chairman Mao or something, you would get, unanimous, 100%, everyone votes for the top leadership. Yes, we all love them. But the way to show your sort of disapproval of certain people was either to abstain. So those people who didn't get their full tally of votes were the people who tended to be less popular. Now, this time, there have been some news reports that there is discussion of having more candidates than there are positions and actually having some people not get voted into power. Another issue that everybody's watching is that currently the most powerful standing committee of 9 people, will that be reduced to 7? Because what happened in the past few years is that there was a stalemate. They weren't getting decisions made. The analysis is that there were 9 people. It's more difficult to get an agreement. And so that's something to be watched for. So, I mean, there are things, to look out for during the party congress. Yes, there's a lot of formality, but there's, if you want to read the tea leaves, you can actually come up with something interesting.
And what is it like, let's say, as a foreigner covering this? I mean, if you're a foreign reporter based in Beijing, there must be so much red tape to go through to get accreditation.
Well, they've actually streamlined this in the past few years, that now you can just apply online, and if you're credentialed, it's not a big deal. It happens more or less automatically. Now, sometimes they make you go, all the way across town to pick up your credentials, and they always assume that you'll have, at least 10 assistants working for you, so that it's really easy to do that and do all the interviews. But, the internet has made our lives somewhat easier.
But I mean, for example, let's say you're a freelancer that's flying into China to cover this. Would they turn you away, or do you have to be a correspondent already based in China?
Well, no. There's something like 1,700, according to a headline. There was something like 1,700 reporters will be covering this. And overseas reporters, they always make a big deal. They want the whole world to watch the ceremony, as long as they don't criticize it, of course. Reporters overseas can apply for credentials, but usually, and I'm not familiar with what's happened this year, but if you're a freelance reporter, that's really frowned upon. You need to have, usually you need to have a well-known organization backing you. And one of the big problems now, of course, is that since much of the international media or new media is appearing that is only online, and China has not yet recognized that online journalists are actually journalists, that if you work for something, like the Huffington Post, for example, you probably wouldn't be recognized as a journalist and get credentials to come and cover this. And so that's a big issue that media has yet to deal with here, or the international media hasn't really come out very forcefully on, and the Chinese government is very reluctant to change its rules because, of course, they are very concerned about what if journalists for their own online media thought that they should have the rights of state, Xinhua, et cetera, et cetera. That would be a real problem.
I suppose at the same time, they're also afraid, let's say, of citizen journalists going into the system.
Oh, my gosh. Please, don't even mention it. That is, some of the citizen journalists in China have done very amazing work and developed a real following, and the state does its best to stamp them out.
Jocelyn Ford, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And I was speaking there with PCJ Radio's Beijing correspondent, Jocelyn Ford. Next week on the program, we'll have more for you about the party congress that took place. You're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio. If you wish to contact us, our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. That's focus@pcjmedia.com. All of the 23 South Korean nuclear reactors will be checked. This was after it was revealed that thousands of parts were supplied to two reactors using forged safety documents. Two reactors have been shut down, and the head of the power utility company, Korea Electric Power Corporation, has offered his resignation. The 23 power plants supplied almost a third of the country's nuclear energy, and that seems to be under threat. Radio Australia's Liam Cochran speaks next to Sun Jin-yun, an associate professor of the Graduate School of Environmental Studies in Seoul.
The public are much suspicious about nuclear reactor safety. After the Fukushima accident last year, the Korean public became a little more suspicious of safety of reactors. Actually, before the accident, Korean public supported the nuclear power very strongly. According to the public opinion survey, more than a little 90% of our public supported nuclear power plants. Maybe Korea has little capacity of fossil fuel, so it is mandatory to use nuclear reactors, especially in facing of the energy depletion and climate change. But nowadays, more and more public came to oppose the use of nuclear power plants. And currently, we have this kind of breakdown of several reactors. I think public are very suspicious about safety of nuclear power.
So what are the alternatives then if South Korea is not well placed to use fossil fuels? What are the energy alternatives for the country?
Actually, we will have a presidential election in December 19th. Two non-ruling presidential nominee or candidate oppose the expansion of nuclear power in Korea, and they argue we need to reduce our energy consumption, especially electricity consumption, through demand-side management and expansion of renewable energy. Those arguments were always provided by counter-energy expert in Korea. And because of this kind of some breakdown of nuclear reactors, people are concerned about maybe the safe or reliable supply of electricity through nuclear reactor, I think. So it is very important to reduce the increasing direction or increasing electricity consumption in Korea. That comes first. And then we need to expand renewable energy use. That is the way we need to follow.
What sort of renewable energy technologies would be most appropriate for Korea?
Many experts think solar energy is the most important in Korea because we have abundant sunshine, and maybe we can use wind power, but some experts criticize our wind speed or direction of wind is not good enough. But still, I think we can use offline, on the ocean or some small size we can use, not just the big size, I think. So nowadays, public participation from the bottom is maybe most important. Many experts are arguing the participation from the public is most important, especially small-scale PVs is very important. That is the most expecting way for our energy sustainable future. That is the situation here.
And finally, on the program, around 200 babies are born in the Philippines every hour. And increasingly, it's poor teenagers who are the mothers, some as young as 13. For more than a decade now, Philippine lawmakers have been trying to pass legislation that would allow state-funded contraception and mandatory sex education in schools. But this has been blocked by every turn by the Catholic Church. We have this report from Keisha West in the Philippines.
It's Sunday morning in Marikina, on the outskirts of Manila. Every inch of the town's 400-year-old church is packed for Mass. 90 million people live in the Philippines. Around 76 million, or about 80%, are Catholic. And the presence of the church is evident in every aspect of daily life, particularly when it comes to family planning. Gabriel Reyes is from the Catholic Bishops' Conference of the Philippines.
It's against the moral law, no? For us, it's contraception is against the natural moral law regarding marriage.
But with populations soaring and with it teenage pregnancies, increasingly even Catholic Filipinos have come to believe this way of thinking might be damaging the country and its people. And it's the very poorest here who are having the most babies. Cherry Francisco has just given birth to her third child, but she has lost another three.
14 years old ako nung nagkaroon ako ng baby.
I was 14 years old when I first got pregnant. Now this is on my sixth pregnancy. The very first baby died inside my womb at 8 months.
The Jose Fabela Memorial Hospital is one of the world's busiest maternity hospitals, and the sheer number of babies being born each day, an average of 70 to 80, sometimes up to 130, means mums and babies have to be prepared to share. Supervising nurse Mary Dungo.
On a single bed, we have two mothers, but we put two beds together. We call them tandem bed, and we have four mothers and four babies in two beds.
While it's very rare for a baby or mother to die during childbirth in this hospital, it does sometimes happen. Across the Philippines, maternal mortality rates in particular have jumped almost 40% since 2006. And the nurses here say meeting their Millennium Development Goals of reducing that rate is next to impossible. The United Nations has urged the Philippines to fast-track a bill which will allow state-funded contraception and mandatory sex education in schools. Ugochi Daniels is the head of the UN Population Fund in the Philippines.
Every day that services and information is not provided is measured in the number of women and girls who lose their lives while trying to give life.
The proposed reproductive health bill has been blocked by the powerful Roman Catholic Church and its political allies for more than a decade. But now the bill has an arguably equally powerful force supporting it, the Philippine president himself.
Items like sex education, for instance, how can anyone argue that there is such a need? No? Shouldn't be deriving your knowledge from your peer group who are actually as ignorant as you.
The principal author of the RH bill, Congressman Edsel Lagman, is confident the bill can be passed by the end of the year.
We are not able to sustain our human development because we are not able to address the population problem.
But Bishop Reyes believes the RH bill is not the answer.
To me, the solution there is to teach our children not to have premarital relationships, because if you give them more condoms for the boys, you know, and all these pills, they will have more promiscuity and maybe more pregnancies.
There's been reports that bishops have warned lawmakers that they will campaign against their re-election next year if they support the bill, and that the church has even gone as far as threatening to excommunicate the president himself, something Bishop Gabriel Reyes denies.
We are not happy about it, and I hope he will change his mind. Well, I don't know if he can still change his mind, no? Because he is promoting something which we think is not good for the country.
The church says if the bill is passed, it will fight it in the Supreme Court.
And with that report from Keisha West, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. Once again, our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. And if you wish to download this edition, as well as all past editions, go to our website, www.pcjmedia.com www.ukraine.org/FAP. On behalf of the whole team, this is Keith Powell wishing you well. We'll see you in 7 days' time. Bye-bye, everyone.